We're on the air with the School Kids Questionnaire, brought to you by the makers of Alka-Seltzer and one-a-day brand vitamin tablets. And here they are, the Quiz Kids.
Welcome to another edition of Words and Pictures here on KBOO Community Radio. I'm Ken Jones, your host for today's show. In this episode, we interview Michael Kupperman, author of the book All the Answers from Simon & Schuster's Gallery 13. All the Answers is a graphic memoir of Michael's father, Joel Kupperman, who became famous during World War II as the youngest member of the Quiz Kids radio show and spent the rest of his life trying to escape that celebrity. The book was selected by Publishers Weekly as one of the best summer books of 2018 and more recently named one of the 2019 finalists for the very prestigious Will Eisner Comic Industry Award in the category of Best Reality-Based Work. The book is also a finalist for the 2019 Excellence in Graphic Literature Award in the Adult Nonfiction category. In addition to All the Answers, Michael is the author of three books of comics, Snake and Bacon's Cartoon Cabaret, Tales Designed to Thrizzle Volume 1, and Tales Designed to Thrizzle Volume 2, which included the 2013 Eisner Award-winning short story, Moon 1969, The True Story of the 1969 Moon Launch. He also wrote and illustrated the humor book, Mark Twain's Autobiography, 1910 to 2010, and has published comics in The New Yorker, Fortune, The New York Times, Adult Swim, and Vice, in addition to DC and Marvel titles. Grant Morrison calls All the Answers a moving tale of fathers and their sons, a cautionary fable from the primal dawn of the age of celebrity. This book is brilliant. Michael Kupperman, thanks for joining us on Words and Pictures.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
Michael, first I have to say I agree with Grant Morrison. It's a brilliant book, one of the best graphic novels I've ever read, but it's somewhat unexpected based on your previous work like Tales Designed to Thrizzle, which is very funny to the point of the surreal and the absurd. You write that you had been working on the book for years, and much of that origin story is in the early chapters of the book. Can you tell our listeners when you started thinking about doing the book and what was the inspiration?
Well, I had always had it in mind to investigate or try to understand my father's childhood, because it was such a bizarre thing. But I didn't want to, let's put it that way. I didn't want to investigate it, but I was also curious. You know, I was conflicted. So when he had retired, I did interview him about it, and this was 2010, but even then I wasn't sure that I was going to do anything with it. And his answers were so inconclusive, it didn't really inspire anything. I think it was in 2012, when he was diagnosed with dementia, that I really started to feel like if I was going to do something, I'd better do it right away. But even then, I didn't fully commit to doing it. I think it was not until a year later that I really pushed everything else aside and tried to concentrate on it just completely. And then there was the research aspect, which is touched on in the book, but also there was the just thinking about your family aspect, which can be really challenging. It's almost like mountain climbing. You need to find a foothold first to climb up, you know. So where's that little niche that you can find in your family that you start thinking about, and then it widens?
What was that niche?
To confuse the metaphor.
What was that niche in this case?
Yeah. I mean, it was the slow realization of how important this all actually had been. And so it was partly just the realization. I mean, I'd always had the idea for myself that I would escape this town I'd grown up in and the family. Just escape as much as I could. And everything I'd grown up with. And it wasn't until much later that you start to realize you can't really escape stuff. It's always going to be linked to you. Like, you're always linked to that part of yourself that experienced it in that time. So it was realizing, you know, first how much that had affected me, and that, you know, the pretense that this hadn't done anything to him was flawed. And then that through him, we'd all experience secondhand effects from it.
And
I guess I'm not explaining it very well.
I understand, and we'll go into it further. I think people will get the idea as we get more into the book. You mentioned you were conflicted, and I know part of that was delving into the secrets of your father and the family and writing about that. But also you mentioned that you've described it previously as a total departure from everything you've done before. It's serious. It's not funny. Not necessarily. It's not supposed to be funny. It's not humor. It's not absurd. It's not surreal. It's very real, very serious. Was that part of why you were conflicted, that it was such a departure from your previous comics?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, being a humorist is it's challenging, but in some ways very a safe area for me. So, I think part of how I developed into doing this book was by feeling kind of pushed out of any comfort zone. And part of that was, you know, the collapse of publishing following the economic disasters that have defined this century. You know, so I was already kind of pushed out of my comfort zone. And I honestly, up to a point, I would have taken an excuse to get out of doing this project. Once I saw what I saw, I saw, you know, I had to do it, because once you've seen certain things about your family, you can't turn your back on them, really. You have to follow through, you know. And it was also that, you know, since my father had dementia and my mother was getting older, and I have a sibling, but they have no children, in a way, I'd become the de facto center of the family. So I was it now. You know, I made the decisions. I'm the archivist. You know, I'm, you know, with my wife's help. She's great. But you know what I mean? It's like, it was also about wanting to rewrite the narrative, you know, from just, you know, a bunch of stuff happened and it doesn't mean anything, to try to really figure out what did happen and what did mean something.
I consider it not only a departure for you from your previous work, but I consider it also an artistic leap. I mean, it's just a great, great book. It reminded me in several ways of Art Spiegelman's book, Mouse, which was also about his father. Your father wasn't in a concentration camp during World War II, but you do depict life as a Jew in America during that time. Was Spiegelman and Mouse an influence? I also heard that you mentioned David Small's graphic memoir, Stitches, as an example.
Yeah. Spiegelman was an influence, absolutely, and I reread Mouse before starting on this. And David Small's book, yes, was an influence, because I felt that the flow in his book was quite excellent. You could read all the way through his book very easily, and I absolutely mean that as a compliment. And that is what I tried for as my book. With my book, I wanted to have it be, you know, this material that's this kind of odd story from my father's and my life, and have it be completely comprehensible with an easy read, which I think, you know, is completely doable. It's just a lot of effort.
You've mentioned that you saw some negative examples of graphic memoirs that weren't so easy to read. And you adapted somewhat of a comic book structure, including going back and reading the man I mentioned who blurbed you, Grant Morrison.
Yes. Yes. Yes, he's one of the absolute best writers in mainstream comics. Yeah, I was reading a lot of mainstream comics as well, and it was interesting to note the differences between them, such as that the mainstream, you know, superhero comics will include visual information that's not actually covered in the text. I find that a weakness of a lot of the more serious graphic novels, that they are fully descriptive in the text, and there's nothing in the imagery that's not covered. You know what I mean? So I tried to have to take from that, to have a lot that wasn't covered in the text kind of shown or heavily implied.
And I think you do that a lot through facial expressions. There's one video I looked at on your website. It was of your father on Quiz Kids, I think, and the host was Fran Allison.
Yes,
and,
yes.
She was of the famous Kukla, Fran, and Ollie. And he answered a question, a mathematical question, in great detail. The camera switched over to Fran, and she looked like she would rather been anywhere else but on that TV set at that moment. And you captured that almost exactly as the video. None of that was in the text. It was all in the illustration itself. I thought that was beautifully done.
Thank you. It's an uncanny moment. I don't know if you can still find it on YouTube, but she, just for a fraction of a second, she looks straight into the camera, which, you know, she was the consummate professional. And this, I think, was Friday, 8:30 p.m. on NBC National. And it's as if she's looking at the camera like, is anyone still watching? Is that still on? While my father is speaking.
You'd figure that he might have gotten viewers to tune out. It was he got the answer right, but he mentioned every little step and how he arrived at it, thinking out loud. And yeah, it wasn't really...
It's just bizarre.
Yes, it wasn't great
watching
television.
Watching this nerd, you know, laboriously answer this question. It's like something from... It's like being in high school, you know, again. It's really odd that that's what they were showing at, you know, peak prime time.
Right.
Around the country.
Now, you mentioned doing a lot of research for the book. And at the end of the book, in fact, you have a partial list of sources. One of them includes a Philip Roth novel, The Anatomy Lesson, which actually references your father, Joel Kupperman. Can you tell us how you went about finding these sources and doing the research? You actually went to certain libraries and the Paley Center for Television Archives?
Oh, yes. Well, the Roth thing I'd known about for years, of course, but I did a lot of research online. It's absolutely fascinating to do research online because from year to year, the results you get change dramatically. And it's like you're fishing in this giant ocean, and whatever, you know, is washed up towards you, you'll find. So I found many other things since then that I, you know, hadn't seen before doing the book. But it is amazing what you'll find online if you really search. It's like a huge attic now, you know, where people shove their memories, and it's just incredible. But there was so much research accumulated, especially after finding the scrapbooks, which, you know, is the event that starts the book.
Yes.
There's so much in there that I'm still noticing stuff. You know, it was impossible to go through absolutely every single item. So there was a lot of skimming, obviously. But, you know, I'm still realizing this or that, like that Hedy Lamarr was there at the Hollywood canteen that night, or, you know.
Chico Marx
encounters
Jack Benny. Chico Marx, Jack Benny. It was lot of celebrities. Orson Welles, Marlena Dietrich, your father.
Oh, hobnobbed. Those are the ones where I could find evidence, uh-huh. Where they were on broadcasted programs. But there are others. I know that people were on the Quiz Kids. Jimmy Stewart, John Carradine. If you know, I like odd movies. So Susan Cabot for me was an exciting one. You know, J. Edgar Hoover and Eleanor Roosevelt did spotlight questions on there in the 40s in shows that have been lost. I think this was in 45. But I don't know if that meant they were live in the studio. I think they were probably recorded in. But still, you know, it was a huge amount of stuff that I found. But that was just a fraction of what I imagined was out there.
And you mentioned earlier these attics, that the internet was like these attics where people store their memories and their secrets. In this case, it was the 5 scrapbooks that you found in your childhood house in Connecticut. Can you tell a little bit about that story? You think they were put together by your grandmother and your father, Joel's mother, Sarah?
Yes. And that he had shoved them into this hiding space, basically in his office. He must have done it, I don't know, 20 or 30 years ago, maybe more. I don't know when they were sent to him. But obviously, he went through a phase when, you know, as he was contracting dementia, where he seemed really excited that I was doing this book. But obviously, at that point, he'd lost all memory of this stuff he had stored, you know, hidden away. And I found a few other things that were really interesting. There's a Esquire magazine all-star baseball game program from, it's either 45 or 46, where he and Harv Fishman are the ball boys for teams headed by Babe Ruth and Ty Cobb.
Uh-huh. And Harv Fishman was another Quiz Kid who later became Harv Bennett,
right.
Who had quite a career in Hollywood, I guess.
Yeah, an amazing career. Star Trek II. Wrath of Khan. That was probably his greatest achievement. But he had a long and distinguished career.
Oh, can we talk a little bit about your dad then? He started as a child prodigy in math. How did that lead to his first appearance on the Quiz Kids radio show? He was only 6 years old at the time.
No, he was 5.
Oh, he was 5. Of a prodigy.
His first appearance was April 29th, 1942. And his birthday is May 18th. So he was actually... just short of his 6th birthday. And his first appearance, I guess he really impressed them, but he only knew math. So that was when they said, come back and, you know, do a little studying and bring him right back, please. And I think by October of that year, he was a regular.
Now, the producer of the show, and this is very clear in the book, you go over the history of the Quiz Kid. The creator producer was a man named Louis G. Cowan. His original surname was Cohen. He was Jewish. And you speculate in the book that your dad's Jewishness and the fact that three of the other main Quiz Kids were Jewish led to him being promoted as a celebrity during this very difficult time in American history.
Yes, this was something my father was saying when I interviewed him. And it didn't even strike me that much at first, but I thought about it more and more, and it seemed more and more conspicuous. Also, when I found out Cowan was one of the main people in radio propaganda during the war, that seemed like a contributing piece of evidence. But there's more than that. It's that if you take my father's fame and take away the Jewishness, it doesn't make any sense at all. Whereas if you plug in the Jewish aspect, it makes enormous sense.
Well, he was somewhat of a lovable, adorable character at first. He had a very engaging lisp, I've read. But other than that, you feel that Cowan was trying to promote Jewishness during the war to combat the anti-Semitism, that not only in Germany, of course, but in the U.S.?
Yes, I think so. I do think so. I mean, I've found citations. I really searched, and I went up and looked through his papers at Columbia. Of course, there was no smoking gun there, but I have found citations that he, you know, had input on radio shows that were being made by other people and would request that Black characters or servicemen be featured in certain ways propagandistically. So really, it doesn't seem that much of a leap to me, given that my father said that was his main impression, really, after all these years. And then he said at another point in the interviews I did with him, they were very smart liberal men, I think was the way he phrased it. And they told me several times how good what I was doing was for the Jews.
Another example of that, and you have that in the book, is a concentration camp survivor after the war and after he was liberated appeared on Quiz Kids. His name is David Hoffman. And your drawing of David was just extraordinary. I mean, it was like every other character in the book, but the eyes, they still haunt me. I don't know how you got that effect, but it's kind of like he saw things that a human, certainly a child, should have never seen.
Actually, I drew another. I couldn't find any pictures of David Hoffman. So the fact is I drew another child who died in the concentration camps.
But it was the eyes that got me. It was
right.
You could tell without expressing too much in the text that he was a survivor of some terrible things there in Nazi Germany. Mm. The other thing I wanted to bring up, too, about the anti-Semitism, you go into the book about your father meeting one of the top anti-Semites in the U.S. for many years, Henry Ford. He even handed out anti-Semitic texts in Ford dealerships throughout the country. And yet it seems like he had come to some kind of a crossroad when he met your dad, and he was trying to atone for some of that after he found out about the horrors of the war.
It's one of those mysteries. Yeah. Was he trying to understand better? Was he doing it for reasons of public relations, or was he really just curious? It's really hard to tell. I do know now that my father didn't have a cold that day. He had been deliberately kept back because my grandmother was scared of Ford, who had such a reputation as an anti-Semite.
And yet Ford came to your father's hotel. He wasn't going to be put off. He wanted to meet him.
Yes, and my father's only recollection about him, as it was about most people, was he was a nice man.
Yes, you make that clear in the book. He says that about almost everybody that he knew, because he was trying to forget that period.
Everyone except Jack Benny, who he thought didn't like him.
Did he say why, or he just got that impression?
No, he did. He just, everything was a vague impression by this point. He just thought Benny didn't like him. And in fact, he was bumped from his first highly publicized appearance on Benny. So I don't know, maybe. he had a kind of friendship going with Fred Allen, though, and they even exchanged letters once or twice.
Maybe that's why Benny didn't like him. They had an on-air rivalry, the two of them.
Yeah, maybe. It's possible. If you you can find this online, though. There's a Fred Allen show called Murder at the Penthouse, and the quiz kids come on and do a whole spoof of detective stories. And it's actually, my father is very funny in it, I have to say.
He's also in a movie with Donald O'Connor. I actually saw the clip, and it seemed like he didn't really want to be there in the movie, but he made it work. It was he was a genius, a child prodigy in there, and Donald O'Connor was a serviceman. I didn't quite get the plot, but it was a World War II era.
Basically, he wants to join the Naval Academy, and Donald O'Connor takes him to see the crusty old dean, and then my father answers a bunch of math and general interest questions, and the dean can't believe it. And, you know, my dad's in the Naval Academy. That's it. There was supposed to be. It was interesting to see because I could trace this in the scrapbooks how it developed. It was put together by a producer called Jack Skirball, who I think is the one the Skirball Center at NYU is named after. And originally, it was supposed to be an adaptation of a different radio show, Duffy's Tavern. It was supposed to be a Duffy's Tavern movie, and then it got changed to this. Originally, I think the name was The Third Glory, but then they changed it to Chip Off the Old Block. But the original storyline, which I really like the idea of, was that my father would be stuck in an attic. like with a pile of books, and professors would keep sticking their heads up to ask him questions, which I thought was a really funny idea. But then they came up with just this cameo thing, and I think they were very frustrated working with him. That's the sense I got. There are lots of news reports of how much trouble he was, and you can see in that scene he's suppressing, he's doing something weird with his hands, like he can't quite stop himself. And there are stills of him being made up and put in a full naval uniform. So I think they even attempted a follow-up scene, but then it was just probably too much work and they gave up.
Well, he was a reluctant actor. It seemed he was kind of pushed into something he didn't really want to do.
Yeah, his fame really depended on radio.
Louis G. Cowan comes back to the story later after the war. And Quiz Kids, he became president of CBS TV, and he created, and I didn't know this until I read your book, the $64,000 question and the $64,000 challenge. He put your father on the latter show, the challenge. Your father made one appearance, won $8,000, never went back to win the 64, never appeared on radio and TV again. What happened?
I think actually he made two appearances. I think the first one was just very uneventful. But I reconstructed it in the book the way I believe it happened from what my mother said my father had told her and from what I read about how these shows would rig things up. They were very, very clever. They wouldn't approach the contestants themselves. They would get other contestants who they had already compromised to do it and do it in a place outside of their place of business. But this was definitely an open secret by, say, 57, when my father was on. I was seeing pretty open references in the papers, like blind items about, oh, we see contestants for a certain game show running to the library with slips of paper. So what I think happened with my father, which I presented, is that someone else approached him, another contestant, off the grounds, you know, of the show, and then showed him a book, which either the title of which or chapter titles were the questions he was going to be asked that evening. And I do believe that it happened, as I showed it in the book, that he must have realized this while he was on air, that he had been set up in this way. I think it must have been like a lot of nightmares that he'd had coming true for him at once. You know, and there had been constant questions about the Quiz Kids and whether they were being prompted, you know, through the years. And so I think up till then he could have said, no, I've never received any prompting. And this was the moment when he saw how the system had set him up, because he made that mistake of going back to try to make some actual money this time. And I think it just finished him in a sense right there.
That was the breaking point.
That was it. Yeah.
And so, it was interesting, Michael, you say in the book after that, he became a philosopher. That was his a professional philosophy teacher, devoting himself to studying character, morality and ethics, almost as a way of kind of wiping that out.
Yes. Well, when you realize that your old mentor and your own mother have set you up to be dishonest on national TV, that's gotta hurt.
Oh, yeah. It was amazing that he recognized that and didn't play along. I think probably many people did. And then even our Louis G. Cowan, the creator of Quiz Kids, and then $64,000 question, his career also ended after the scandal broke and they had the congressional investigations into the game shows.
He claimed to be innocent, but he was absolutely blamed more than anyone and ousted from the network. And there was a lot of acrimony in the press between him and the network at the time. CBS was a very odd operation. I don't know how much it still is. And Simon & Schuster is a division of CBS now.
But, they're the publishers, of course, of the book.
Yeah. In the 60s, there are definite organized crime influences coming in. It's a weird stew, and it always makes me more curious.
Now, you talked about the book, writing it as a painful experience. I think it shows a lot of courage and bravery to kind of stick it out and to finish the book. It wasn't just painful for you. There's some very painful parts for the reader in there. In terms of sadness, there's one thing, one memory of yours from the early 70s that you put in the book that particularly struck me and made me cry, actually, when I read it. You and your father are pictured in a pool, and you're asking him, "Daddy, do you love me?" And your father, Joe Kupperman, answers, "Some of the time." It's an honest answer, I guess, but devastating to a child. I mean, not only did you live through the actual experience, but then you relived it when you were doing the book. What was that
like? It was rough. It was rough to retell, and it was a tough memory.
Was that cathartic at all, retelling it in the book?
Sure. I mean, all of this, you know, the whole experience made me stronger. You know, it was an intense undertaking. But I find the memory later in the book, which was during our second interview, where he says that nobody told him to have a relationship with me. That, to me, is an intensely painful memory and just reality to live with, to hear that.
Oh, yes. And that's the end of the second to last chapter. You put that there. Yeah. You're speaking about endings. I read on your website that when you submitted the manuscript, there was a different ending, maybe some additional material that, based on the editor's suggestions and some realizations that you came to, you changed. So the final version that I've read is different. What were some of those changes?
There was more of an effort made to really understand and explain the effects all this had on me. And there were a lot more pages about me, and I felt that... ultimately, this is more of a story about him, and that if I wanted to show the effects on me, they should be told as economically as possible, not with any drawn-out explanation. And I think my editor said, and I think he was right, they had more of an angry tone to them, just because of the fact that I think my father sort of installed in me strong preferences for which are great for remaining hidden. But if you don't want to remain hidden, they can produce anger, you know, when you struggle against these preset kind of controls to remain cloaked. So there was more of that. And I didn't have an ending yet, basically, not really. So I think I really needed to find a way to bring it full circle and to kind of bring it home and to have... if not an upbeat note, you know, one of, you know, questioning, perhaps.
Oh, I just wanted to bring up a quote related to that from your Paris Review interview last year, Michael. You said, "I'm an extremely conflicted person. I have a need for attention that's central to who I am, but I also have a strong need to avoid attention, an instinct to hide that's very hard for me to fight. I'm modest, but not in a healthy, pleasant way, in a profoundly self-negating way that has worked against me in many situations. I struggle with an extremely negative self-image. Most of this, I realize, can be traced back to the way I was raised." And you made that clear. You think a lot of that comes from your relationship with your father.
Yeah, I mean, he was an incredibly emotionally and in some ways intellectually absent father. He was you know, a lot of the time it was like being around someone who was hypnotized. I don't know if you saw the new version of Twin Peaks, but
oh, not yet. I haven't.
Kyle MacLachlan has a couple of different personas in there, but there's one that reminded me very much of my father, kind of genuinely benign and caring, you know, positive emotionally, but also absent in many regards. So yeah, that did make, you know, growing up much harder because there was no one to ask about things and there was no one to consult. And he just had no idea how to be a father in many ways. He had never thought it through and there was no one to tell him. And he was kind of off in his own world anyway. So yeah, it was hard like that. And then, you know, we moved to Cambridge, England when I was seven, which was kind of almost a repeat of when he escaped to Cambridge. And so for 2 years we were in Cambridge. My mother was getting her PhD and my sibling and I went to the public school, and my father was a fellow at King's. And those were, you know, certainly in retrospect, magical times. It's a beautiful place. It was just full of smart people and culture, you know, theaters and bookstores everywhere, medieval buildings, countryside. It was really stimulating. And, we kind of all were in love with it. And then I think we all in the family, except my father, of course, remember how sad it was to come back to where we'd been living in Mansfield, Connecticut, and try to resume our lives there. You know, it really messed with us, I think, at least myself, my mother, and my sibling. My father, I think, was back where he felt comfortable. You know, that was kind of the first step towards setting me up as a complete outsider for the rest of my life, because now I was in love with theater and irony and reading, and I was, you know, in this cow town, basically, where, you know, I had an English accent. It was just, you know, it was not good. And then, you know, I got unhappier and happier, unhappier. The conditions at home got worse and worse because, you know, whereas my father is a generally passive, quiet person, my mother and I are much louder, shoutier people, and things got more and more heated. And then when I was 14, they sent me off to private school, which was just the biggest mistake. It was just a terrible thing to do. And, you know, I've been thinking about it recently. Part of the problem was that, you know, they wanted in some ways for me to be a well-rounded person and I guess slip into the upper middle classes somehow. But the home life was so Slobovian. My parents are very, very bright people, but they're the children of first generation immigrants. And, you know, I had been raised with lower class habits in many ways. And then to go to this environment of people who had nothing going for them but their upper class manners and pretense, it was just a disastrously awful experience and had the complete opposite effects from what they intended.
How did you deal with that? Is that when you started drawing?
No, I was already drawing by then, but it just, you know, it really, it kind of finished me in a way. You know, from then on, it made me a complete outsider. You know, if they had set out to do it, they couldn't have done it much better, I think. But, you know, and the class that they hoped me to be part of, it made me despise that class. You know, I can't stand those people.
Now, your father, we had mentioned he was diagnosed with dementia in 2012, and it's not something that there's a cure for. How is he doing now? Is it just much worse? Can you even communicate with him?
He's in what you would think of as the final stage, I guess. He's in stage four, but he can't really communicate. He's not very responsive. He's still, I don't know, he's still hanging on. He's actually in hospice care right now, but they're saying they might pull him back out of it because his health is improving again. But the problem is he's in a home and they keep sending him to the hospital every other week sometimes. It's just terrible. And it's all, as with everything else, a function of the insurance industry, which, you know, yeah. So, you know,
Now,
he continues.
And I want to get also, you're a father yourself now, and you mentioned your son. His name's Ulysses. You describe him in the book as already a difficult artist. And as mentioned, I follow you on Twitter. You often mention him very fondly and adoringly. What did your experiences as Joel Kupperman's son teach you about being a father to Ulysses?
To do the opposite as much as possible from what my father did. I think, again, my father was emotionally a loving and kind-natured person. He just didn't really have the tools or know that there were tools. But for me, I try to, you know, I spend a lot of time with him. I, you know, do things with him. I taught him drawing not because I thought, oh, he should be drawing. It's a good thing to do. It was partly because he has such immense energy and so much going on upstairs that it was a kind of like showing him a place where he could, you know, stop for a bit. That's what drawing can really give you also is, you know, a kind of even a fugue state, but a remove from, you know, the normal routine. And it's worked like that for him very well as a kind of outlet for him to pour all this mental and intellectual energy going on. I try to, you know, pay attention to who he is and not try to force him to be some arbitrary idea of what a person is supposed to be these days. And you know, from what I had growing up, nearly everything I was brought up to believe a person should be was just not true.
And not who you were.
And not worth it, you know. And I do feel, I'll be honest, I feel like I was brought up to be racist, to be, you know, in some ways not a good person. And, you know, not necessarily by my parents, but by the system that surrounded us. And, you know, so basically a lot of what I do as a parent is trying to let my child follow his own instincts because they are genuinely sound. The thing that I feel was done to me and a lot of other kids was that my instincts were constantly challenged or stepped on or, you know, dismissed. But, you know, he's a vegetarian. He's enormously healthy. He loves sweet things, but, you know, he doesn't overindulge. He's not attracted to violent media at all. And we haven't placed limitations on this stuff. You know, he just really isn't interested. You know, he follows his own path,
which is the way a child should do it. But a lot of parents don't allow that. Now, Michael,
yeah, I think so. The school system isn't crazy about it either.
That's for sure. Now, you recently started a Patreon campaign to help support your work. What's the idea behind that? And can you tell our listeners, if they like your work, and I think they'll especially love this book, All the Answers, how they can help support your Patreon campaign, where to go?
Oh, sure. Well, I think I'm findable on Patreon. I'm all ages. And I started doing it because I've... felt the need to build more of a relationship with the people who like my work, with the hope that I can stop trying to please, you know, outside editors and so on, and just get involved in all these aborted projects that don't work out, and the endless frustration of trying to do anything in modern media or publishing. It just has become an absolute nightmare over the last 30 years. I guess I've been doing it for 25 years now. And it's just terrifying how badly everything is going and how few things work out. So my feeling is, I mean, for instance, my humor work, which I enjoy doing and will continue to do, I don't know if there's any outlet for it right now. I mean, at all, to have it published or to have it run anywhere. I think for me, the only answer now is to start finding ways to fund it myself, print it myself, and distribute it. And Patreon is part of that, where I'm trying to build a relationship with the people who enjoy my work. And then if they contribute, use that to make new work that is, you know, the work I'm interested in doing. I spent years working for, you know, The New Yorker, The New York Times, places like that, and just not really doing my best work. So all of that feels a little bit like wasted time now. And I would rather just do work that I feel good about, you know?
And I think you should feel very good about All the Answers. It's just one of the best graphic novels, graphic memoirs I've ever read. So I want to thank you for that. Well, Michael Kupperman, thanks so much for joining us today at KBOO. I really appreciate it. And the book is just marvelous.
Oh, thank you so much, Ken. Thank you for having me.
We've been talking with Michael Kupperman, author of the graphic memoir All the Answers from Simon & Schuster's Gallery 13. You can find out more about Michael and his work at michaelkupperman.com. And if you'd like to help support his future projects, he's on Patreon at patreon.com/Michael Kupperman. I'm Ken Jones, and this has been Words and Pictures on KBOO Community Radio. You can find an archived version of the show later today at kboo.fm/words and pictures, and be sure to follow us on Twitter at, of course, Words and Pictures Singular. Many thanks to Michael for talking with us at KBOO, to S.W. Concer, the host of the show, for giving us this time, and to all of you for listening.
And now, this is Joe Kelly dismissing the quiz kids until next Sunday at this same time. Good night, kids.
Good night, Mr. Kelly.
Listen to the quiz kids every Sunday at the same time. And on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday, listen to your old friends, Lum and Abner, on most of these same stations. This is Fort Pearson speaking.